Daniel Pipes is an historian, a writer, and commentator, a long-standing expert on politics in the Middle East. His many books include In the Path of God, The Rushdie Affair, and now Israel Victory, How the Zionists Win Acceptance and Palestinians Get Liberated. That is our topic today. Welcome, Mr. Pipes.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
You note right at the beginning of the book a startling statistical fact. That is that among prosperous nations in the world, Israel is the only one whose birth rate exceeds replacement level. What is your reading of that trend? What do you think it implies?
It is very dramatic. At a time when Europe and even the United States are trending towards 1.5 child per woman, and when countries like South Korea and Singapore are well under one child per woman, Israel's population is over 3. And it's not just the Arabic-speaking population. It's not just the Haredim, the so-called ultra-Orthodox, the black hats. It's the general population. So it's astonishing. Nothing comparable. No other rich country over 2 children per woman. And here is Israel with 3. I think it has something to do with the Jewish heritage, the Holocaust, the wanting to make up for the destruction of 6 million. But more profoundly, I think it has to do with the sense that life is good. Children should be part of it. A healthy country should have lots of children. And it's growing. The birth rate is growing. Well, just about every other rich country, it's going down. So it points to the exceptionalism of Israel in a way that probably most people are not aware.
Yeah. Yeah. And by contrast, the negativity, right? The sense about life, I think the fertility rate is a good measure of that. Mm-hmm. It doesn't sound good for us. Let's get to another term, really, really fundamental term in your book. Define for us the phenomenon of rejectionism. And perhaps as you do that, perhaps touch upon the influence of an important historical figure in your story, Amin al-Husseini.
Right. There are many antagonisms around the world. The British and French fought for 750 years, a very long time, and very vicious for much of it. There was the Armenian genocide a little over 100 years ago. There was the German Holocaust, already mentioned, German Holocaust of Jews. But there's something extraordinary, and I would argue unique, about the Palestinian attitude towards Zionists, Israelis. And that for close to a century and a half, the Palestinian mentality has been one of utter rejection. No, 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 get out. We want to kill you. So extreme that Amin al-Husseini, whom you just mentioned, appears to have influenced Hitler not to expel the Jews under his dominion, but to murder them. This mentality developed a long time ago, 1880s. And it made sense in a way at the time. There were very few Zionists. They were not skilled. They didn't know the languages. They were new to the area. And the Palestinian overwhelming majority said, no, get out of here. You don't want you. But the remarkable thing is that all these decades later remains in place when it's completely inappropriate, when the Palestinians are the weak ones. Israel has the high rises and the wings of F-35s. Israel has a half for $600 billion GDP. Palestinian, a tiny fraction of that. So despite the inappropriateness and immorality, this mentality continues. And likewise, I argue that the Zionists, going back 140 years, developed a mentality of what I call conciliation, of saying to their neighbors, you'll benefit from us. Don't be so negative. We can win your favor. Clean water, new ports, good road, electricity. You can benefit. Don't be so negative. And I believe that these two extraordinary, unique attitudes, no one else has a conciliatory attitude towards the neighbor, the enemy. These two have put the Palestinian conflict into an amber-like, unchanging, unproductive, violent, miserable relationship that just goes on and on and will continue to go on and on unless somebody does something differently.
Yeah. You know, you marked out really the irrationality of the rejectionism in the 21st century. What impact does holding this attitude have on the psyche of the people who are raised in it? What are they supposed to do? What are they supposed to think when they look at the extraordinary prosperity, advancement in Israel, and then look at their own not so prosperous issues?
The rejectionist mentality leads to venom, leads to self-sacrifice, leads to a feeling of hope that the Jewish state can be destroyed. I think hope is the problem. Now, this is the reverse of conventional analyses. If you look at, say, U.S. government policy, it is always designed to increase the hope. Whether this be Bill Clinton or Donald Trump, the goal is to imbue Palestinians with hope. And I'm saying, no, hope is the enemy. Hope is what leads to suicide bombings, massacres, and the like. Palestinians need to be deprived of it to see that they cannot destroy Israel, that Israel's strong, it's tough, it's got friends, it's resolute, and stop, give up, not working. And that is then in the second part of the book. First part is about how we got here. Second part is what to do about it. I come up with a couple of ideas how Israel can address the Palestinians. I'm not addressing the Palestinians primarily. I'm nor American, but Israeli. And here, Israel, here's a path to victory. Here's a path to ending the conflict. Here's a path to finally reaching a resolution with your enemy neighbor.
Yeah. But let's stick with the rejectionism for a moment. In chapter two, you actually raise the why. Question, why does rejectionism persist in spite of the hardships and the loss that people under its influence have suffered? Why do they keep believing it? What's your answer? What's your explanation, maybe I should say?
Well, there are a lot of factors there. Let me just point to a couple. One is Islam, the sense that Muslims own the territory that is now Israel, that this was under Muslim rule for many centuries and therefore belongs to Muslims. And in addition, there are some holy places there, and therefore it's all the more a Muslim Islamic territory. Another major factor is the global support. In the history of the world, there's never been an insurrection with the international backing of the Palestinians. It's phenomenal, and it's growing, not decreasing. Decades go by, and it gets bigger and bigger. And what's striking is that the Arab states, who were the great supporters of the Palestinian, i.e. anti-Zionist, anti-Israel cause, have basically left the field. They're reluctant participants. They give nominal support. But it is further away Muslims, and in particular, it's the far left. It's the left. I mean, look at the encampments on American college campuses. Look at the destruction at Union Station in Washington some days ago. It's the left. It's not the Muslims.
This was actually my next question, because you touch on this issue in the same section where you talk about the persistence of rejectionism, and I think our listeners would like to hear your note on how the left in the United States and Europe has become strongly pro-Palestinian, especially given certainly the social attitudes of the left in those places don't match social attitudes in the Palestinian world.
Why? Queers for Palestine.
Why the identity? Yeah.
And it's not just North America and Europe. It's Brazil. It's India. It's Japan. It's all over. It's universal. I think there were a sequence of events in the early 1990s, such as the war against Saddam Hussein, the coming together of the European Union, the Oslo Accord, and most especially the ending of apartheid in South Africa in 1994, that created a sense among the left that and the collapse of the Soviet Union, sorry, can't forget that, that the old Cold War memes were done with, and the left looked for new enemy. And the combination of all these factors led to a focus on Israel. Israel became the colonial state, the apartheid state, the white supremacist state, the neo-Nazi state, all the enemies of the left were ascribed to Israel, though it is not any of them, but that's what happened. It became the enemy of the left. This took some years to gel. The 2001 Durban conference was the coming out of this anti-Israel leftist emotion. And it's grown. That's already now 23 years ago, and it's more and more. So now you have, you know, toxic anti-Israel elements in the U.S. House of Representatives. Who knows who Kamala Harris is? Not clear. She might be one of these, might not, but you certainly have some. And also in, you know, many other governments, they're growing in power. But at the same time, I should note that the support for Israel has grown on the right. The support for Israel on the right began very, very faint. In the first decades, Israel was seen as an obstacle towards building alliances against the Soviet Union. Israel was not popular on the right. That began to change, in particular in the 1970s and 80s, and has grown and grown and grown since. So that now it's a very rare conservative in the United States and in many other countries who is hostile to Israel. Conservatives, with, of course, there are always exceptions, tend overwhelmingly to be friendly. And perhaps the poster boy, the poster boys actually are interesting. They're both from the southern cone of South America. Gabriel Boric, the very young president of Chile, is an anti-Zionist fanatic. He wouldn't even accept the papers of the incoming Israeli ambassador. He didn't want to have anything to do with the Israeli ambassador. Despises Israel. On the other hand, Javier Milei is the most pro-Israel leader perhaps ever in 75 years. Remarkable. So, you know, Chile and Argentina, far away from this interaction. And these two politicians, these two presidents, both see Israel and the Palestinians as essential to their political identity.
You spoke of the conciliation attitude, and you note two historical approaches toward the Palestinian leadership. By Israel. One is, quote, you put it, seduce them through economic benefits. The other one is break their will through military strength. Those are your terms. You look at the record and you see that this form of economic benefits enrichments has only produced one result, quote, fueled hatred. Why does the hatred get worse when you're receiving assistance?
Let's go back, for example, to the Oslo Accords of 1993. The Israeli side, in the person of Shimon Peres, the perpetual politician of Israel, came up with the idea of a new Middle East, a kind of Benelux of Israel, the Palestinian territories, and Jordan. Saw economic benefits, tourism, trade, the like. The Palestinian reaction was one of skepticism bordering on conspiracy theory. They couldn't believe this benign intent. They saw this as a way for Israel surreptitiously to take over the Middle East. And the result was, after the Oslo Accords were reached, were signed, that the violence against Israelis increased dramatically, and the rhetoric against them increased dramatically. So there's a profound suspicion, there's a disbelief that the Israelis could possibly mean this. There's a projection. If I want to kill you, how can you want to improve my water supply? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. And the Israelis have gone on merrily for decade after decade and not understood this. Though there has been, as you point out, a minority recessive strain, which has seen this and has argued this, but somehow it's never really had an impact on power. We can see it today in the form of two of the ministers in Prime Minister Netanyahu's government, being Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, who personify this other approach. And they're not unimportant. Their seats are necessary for the government to continue, but they are constantly overridden and pushed aside and derided and ignored. So maybe one day that'll change, but until now, that minority view has really never prevailed.
If you've enjoyed listening to the First Things podcast or reading one of our many articles, please consider supporting our work with a year-end gift today. We are counting on 75 listeners like you to help us reach our goal of $10,000 toward our First Things year-end campaign. Any amount will go a long way toward reaching this goal and supporting the great work done by First Things. Donate now by visiting www.firstthings.com/campaign or by clicking the link in the podcast description. That's www.firstthings.com/campaign.
You bring in another term that isn't quite the same thing as conciliation, and you call it placation. What exactly is that?
Well, I see conciliation as having two parts. The first, the longer running, is enrichment, this idea that the Zionists can win the Palestinian favor by benefiting them. That goes back, as I said, to the 1880s. The much newer, only to the 1993 Oslo Accords, theme is what I call placation, of making sure that the prisons are gentle, of trading, by my count, 461 live Palestinians for every one Israeli prisoner or hostage. By avoiding confrontation, by providing benefit, by avoiding trouble, and hoping that this will lead to an end of hostilities. Again, I mean, look at this in a larger context. I have a whole couple of chapters on the larger context, on defeat and victory in the world. This is absolutely irregular. Nobody else does this. Nobody else feeds and benefits and avoids confrontation with their enemy. This is a uniquely Zionist phenomenon, as rejectionism, this no, 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 absolute no, is a Palestinian feature. These, I argue, are not found elsewhere. I challenge you to come up with the, you know, show me wrong, that there are other examples.
You turn to, as you said, the second half of the book, The Nature of Victory, what victory will look like. And one thing before we get into the specifics of that, you're not going to get any strategy or tactics of victory coming from foreign powers, are you? The record shows this is all going to have to be an Israel initiative.
Yeah. Foreign powers generally do not understand. My poster boy here is George Mitchell, former majority leader of the Senate, who went off to Ireland in the 90s and had the very successful Easter peace agreement. And then he was sent off by both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama to the Middle East to solve the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and went nowhere. Because he approached it as a normal conflict, like the Northern Ireland one. And it's not normal. It's irregular. It's abnormal. And someone has to get into the depth of it. And maybe one day some foreign government will get there, but So far, that's not been the case. And I would go further and point out that many who are sympathetic in the United States tend to blame the errors Israel makes on the U.S. government. Well, the Israelis would have done it right, except for our pressure. No. Our pressure comes from, in many cases, following the Israeli lead and making larger the Israeli mistake. So, for example, I mentioned enrichment. This is a unique Israeli mistake, but the U.S. government and other governments have said, oh, yeah, Israel, you're right. Yeah, let's fund the Palestinians, let's benefit the Palestinians. The more money they get, the better. The most dramatic of these, in fact, was Donald Trump's Peace Through Prosperity plan of 2020, which foresaw getting the Palestinians no less than $50 billion. It's a small population. $50 billion over 10 years is a huge amount of money. It was all premised on their benefiting. No, I argue, no. They need not to benefit. They need to understand that there's a price to be paid. Don't benefit people who are aggressive or violent or rejectionist. Don't benefit them until, unless they've proven that they've gone beyond this. It'd be like funding the Nazis, you know? Don't fund them the Marshall Plan after they've lost, after they've conceded, okay. But not while the war is on.
You implied that one reason that the foreign powers don't pursue the military, the absolute military force tactic, is that, since the end of World War II, nearly half of the wars that have been fought have ended indecisively. They've sort of been one side beating the other, but it's ambiguous. And that was not at all the case in former times. I think you said before that it was about 1% of wars would end decisively. Before this, one side would trounce the other and total defeat, and the whatever feelings of hope or is that sort of a historical context for the diplomatic powers not really recognizing this isn't going to work?
Until 1945, despite the change in technology, there was a constant in warfare that each party went to win victory. And indeed, that was absolute victory was what the American government sought in World War II. With the explosion of two atomic weapons in 1945, that fundamentally changed for Americans and for other Westerners, including Israelis. Not the whole world, not the Russians, not the Chinese, not the Islamists, but for the West, this changed. From 1945 on, the sense was you can't win anymore. What does winning mean? It means the destruction of the globe. Nuclear winter. No point. There's no such thing as victory. All you can do is manage. This had a profound impact because it not only affected U.S.-Soviet relations, but U.S. foreign policy, military policy in general. And so basically one can say that when it comes to major wars, the United States won them all, or almost all, pre-1945, and lost them all, or almost all, after 1945, with management. And that's what the Israelis are doing. They're managing. They're not trying to win. And their opponents are trying to win. Opponents are not influenced by this line of thought, but the Israelis are.
Now, to the matter of Israeli victory, how do things stand now with the Israeli response to October 7th? Is this moving in line of what you prescribed?
In the first few weeks after October 7th, I thought, well, who needs my book? The Israelis have figured this out on their own. But by early November, I found, no, they still need my book. They have not figured this out. They're still making the same old mistakes. Now, what's happened since then is a dual, contradictory, I like to call it oxymoronic, policy. On the one hand, you have Prime Minister Netanyahu speaking without cease about victory. Absolute victory, total victory, complete victory, full victory, decisive victory. I've been keeping track the best of my abilities. I found some 62 expressions of this with 182 mentions of victory. A huge number. And when he came to the United States a couple weeks ago, he had a total victory baseball cap, and he took it on the plane, and he took it when he met former President Trump. Clearly, the prime minister wants victory, and I would say that's good news. On the other hand, both the foreign allies of Israel and the domestic opponents of Netanyahu want to put an emphasis on hostages, the release of hostages, getting the Israeli hostages, 100 plus, out of Hamas's grip, getting them returned to their homes and ending the conflict. The foreign allies want to avoid a larger war in the Middle East. Conflagration. And the domestic allies want to damage the prime minister. And so he's got these two goals at once, of destroying Hamas and negotiating with Hamas. And I argue that those are incompatible. They are contradictory. And sooner or later, the government has to make up its mind. Now, it appears that just yesterday, with the attack in Tehran on Ismail Haniyeh, that it did that. I'm not sure, but it looks like it. This was so dramatic that it appears that it has put aside the possibility of a hostage agreement and put Israel on the victory path, which I hope is the case.
You said that you're not certain of what a Kamala Harris approach to the conflict would be. Do you think the Trump administration will go back to what you warned of in 2020? The enrichment tactic?
Presumably. Though the key designer of that prosperity, peace through prosperity, was, I'm thinking of his name, the son-in-law.
Jared Kushner.
Jared Kushner, yeah, who is gone from the political scene. So perhaps it would be a different approach in the future. But I would assume that any American government will continue with the idea of enrichment, and it will take the Israelis to make that change, and then for the Americans and others to follow them.
Last question. We're going to jump to the American scene. How do you think the Jewish vote will fall out in November?
I think there might be a significant change. The majority of American Jews have not historically seen Israel as a voting issue or the Jewish identity and related topic. Famously, American Jewish women, especially older ones, see abortion as the number one topic. I think the intensity of anti-Israel and indeed anti-Jewish feeling, expressions, activities, including street demonstrations, murders, has possibly led to a change among American Jews and possibly will lead to a significant shift of Jewish votes and Jewish money toward the conservatives, towards the Republican Party. It's a sense. I don't think there's polling yet on this, but I think you know, there have been, ever since Ronald Reagan, 44 years ago, there has been an expectation that American Jews will vote Republican. And that was the high point, by the way, in 1980, of American Jewish support for Republican presidential candidate. It's been disappointed. The Republicans have been disappointed every 4 years. I think this just might be the time when the Republican candidate for president and other offices, of course, as well, does get a significant Jewish vote.
Yeah. The book is Israel Victory: How Zionists Win Acceptance and Palestinians Get Liberated. Daniel Pipes, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Conversations. First Things is a reader-supported publication. To support our work, access our articles, and subscribe to the monthly print edition, please visit firstthings.com today.